Blog Talk Radio.
It's time for a solid hour of Tea Party Power. And now, here's Janine Garofalo's favorite tea-bagging redneck, Mark Gillar.
Welcome to the Tea Party Power Hour. I am your host, Mark Gillar. Our special guest today is Suzanne Venker, the author of The Seven Myths of Working Mothers, as well as the co-author of the recently released The Flip Side of Feminism, What Conservative Women Know and Men Can't Say. This is a very important show, especially for you young women out there, so ask your baby daddies to watch your kid. Settle down in a comfortable chair, get yourself something to drink, and plan to spend the next 50 minutes with us as we take on the many myths of feminism.
Suzanne, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Mark.
Listen, I just finished reading, and I know hosts don't do this all the time, but I just finished reading The Flip Side of Feminism, What Conservative Women Know and Men Can't Say. And I absolutely loved it. There were so many things in there. I was like, yeah, go, say it. Thank you. From a male standpoint, it was nice to hear those things being said. But let's go ahead and start from the beginning a little bit. And tell me about your co-author, Phyllis Schlafly.
Schlafly, yeah.
Schlafly, sorry.
Yeah, no, that's all right. You know, people, and I don't know how old you are. I'm 43 today, as a matter of fact. And thank you. And she's 86. So
wow.
The purpose of the collaboration was because she was the premier anti-feminist of the 20th century, and she led the fight against the Equal Rights Amendment, which I'll come back to that in a second. But so a lot of people in our age group, at least those under 50, I'd say, don't necessarily know her, you know, but there's certainly, if you're over 50, you know who she is. So it's just a generational thing. She also happens to be my aunt, so I do talk a little bit about that in the intro to Flipside. But I thought that bringing her into this project was important because I just felt like, how can I take on these subjects without sort of setting the framework for what happened in the last 40 years? And I thought she would be best to sort of explain the genesis of that movement and what was going on during the 70s, and then I would hone in more on the modern generation. So that's how that came to be.
Now, you had already written, and forgive me, I don't have the book in front of me, but the Seven Myths of Working Mothers.
Yes, in 2004.
Before this, and a successful author in your own right before doing this collaboration. Obviously, she had some influence on you growing up.
I tell you, you know, I would say her influence in my life was not, what I generally do is liken her influence to what people have experienced the last 5 or 6 years with the whole mainstream media, Fox News sort of divide, where people today have these alternative sources for news where they didn't 10 years ago and are much more savvy about media bias. I grew up having that alternative view available to me from the time I was small. So while the world was becoming very liberal around me and certainly very feminist in their thinking, I had this alternative view presented to me. And so because of that, I never fell into that trap that most of the people that I know or most of my contemporaries did. And I think that the reason why I wanted to write this book, part of it was because I had that unique position.
My experience has been, and having only done this show for a year, that the old saying, liberals are all about free speech as long as you happen to agree with them, is very, very true. So what types of fallout have you experienced,
yeah,
or what types of attacks have you and Phyllis experienced for basically exercising your right to free speech?
You know, interestingly enough, as strongly as I feel about feminism and its effect on our society, its negative effect on our society, I feel even more passionate about the whole political correctness and groupthink that mainly conservatives have been dealing with. I cannot tell you how much my writing career has become about this, more than the content sometimes of the books. I'll give you an example. My alma mater, Boston University, published an interview with me on this book, Flipside, and it was a Q&A done over the telephone, and then the writer drew up a, you know, created an article from that interview. And she had a bias, and she was very obvious about that on the phone, although she was professional and cordial. But I have come to learn right away when I'm dealing with somebody who doesn't want to hear what I have to say but is trying to be professional. So you sort of know that when you have an interview being or an article being drawn from that, that it's going to skew things just a bit in the way that they want me to appear. So at any rate, this was published online at BU Today, which is on the front page of our website, theflipsideoffeminism.com, and there were hundreds of responses from angry, mostly from angry women on campus. Now, keep in mind, this is you know, this is going into the lion's den because you're talking about academia here, which of course is just as left of center, or more left actually than the media, and they live in a bubble, and so they don't get this message. So here I am coming along, and you know, they hailed me as here's a BU alum, and she's saying basically the wrong thing. So if you go through those comments, you can see for yourself, and I'm sort of glad that they did this because it sort of proves our point as conservatives for us, that this whole concept of free speech is absolutely a bogus concept for those on the left. They were angry at BU for even allowing the interview to be there, to even be done, much less, you know, what I said.
Well, I don't think what you said even matters, because unless you're embracing feminism or any other liberal cause, you're going to be attacked. I mean, I'm sure a lot of them began writing their response before they were a couple of sentences into the interview or the article. Yeah.
Absolutely. And the same thing happened with the Huffington Post, by the
way. Oh, really? I can't imagine that.
I know, exactly. So, you know, and no, there's no question. I know when I'm dealing with, you know, I know what's going to happen when I'm, you know, anytime you challenge the prevailing orthodoxy, you're going to get tremendous backlash. It's just that it's worse today than ever because we are so divided. But it fuels me all the more because it makes me so angry because it's so wrong. And the saddest thing is, especially when you're talking about these college girls, those are the women I'm trying to reach, because within the group, yes, the majority are always going to fall in step with what they're told. That's human nature. But there is this other group that doesn't, and they have that doesn't fall in line with what they're told, and they need some guidance and some help. And so I got some wonderful emails from students that thanked me. And, you know, that's why I do it.
Well, absolutely. It's those few people that you reach that otherwise wouldn't have access to the information. And I don't like to brag, but I was banned from posting on the Huffington Post. So
you were.
I came back under a different username, but originally, and I still have this, I took a snapshot of the screen that said I'd been banned. They had a night editor named Marcus, I can't even remember now, Barham or something like that. I'll have to go back and look. And he had written this hit piece on Sarah Palin and had taken some video clips out of context to make her look unintelligent. And I said, hey, Marcus, let me show you how easy this is if you decide to do a hit piece. And so I did the same thing to Barack Obama, Nancy Pelosi, and Joe Biden. And then I put it all together, and I went back and put a link and shot the thing all over the internet. And the next time I tried to log into the Huffington Post, it said, you've been banned.
Oh, that's too funny.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Excuse me, I said, I don't think I've ever tried to comment. Maybe I did once. I guess it was pretty benign. That's pretty funny.
It's a lot of fun, you know, to watch. I have that intro, the 57 state thing, and to watch liberals try to explain away some of Barack Obama's less intelligent statements. And, you know, one guy wrote me an email saying, well, what Barack Obama meant was is that the campaign process was so tiring, he felt like he had been to 57 states. And I'm like, okay, thanks for explaining. It's amazing how they look like they're, you know, a contortionist playing a game of Twister when they try to defend him. Well, let's start getting into the book just a little bit. You begin by letting people know that the feminist movement is pretty much predicated on a Marxist worldview. Talk to us a little bit about that.
You know, it's funny that you picked that particular statement, because in the BU, one of the BU comments said something like, as soon as I saw feminism and Marxism, I stopped reading. So,
okay.
I thought that was a perfect encapsulation of when you don't want to know something, you don't want to know it, you know. But it's not quite as scary as it sounds. I'm not meaning that all feminists are Marxists. That's not at all what I said. I'm simply pointing out the genesis of the movement in the 60s with Betty Friedan was a clearly communist movement. A lot of people assume that Betty Friedan simply, they have this image that she tapped into this problem that existed. You know, it's called the problem that has no name, where all these housewives were despondent and miserable and had no life and wanted to get out of their cages. Now, that is absolutely something that she personally experienced, in part because, A, she had a horrific upbringing with a terrible mother who was abusive to her mentally, and, B, she had a horrendous marriage, which came out later and is very public. She was married to Carl Friedan, and they were very abusive to one another. She was miserable. Now, if you take those circumstances, which are very personal, there's no way you're going to be happy in your daily life. So if you're at home with three kids, which she was at the time, obviously you're going to attribute your misery to your existence. So what she did was, rather than get the help that she needed personally in her life, she absolutely admitted, this is even what's even more shocking, that she manufactured a societal problem by saying, quote, "It was easier for me to start the women's movement than to change my own personal life." Now, that is a huge, huge thing, because what you're essentially saying is the genesis of this movement really wasn't a movement that was real, in the sense that she might have garnered a lot of attention, and certainly women who are prone to victimhood and had their own personal problems and jumped on board and said, yeah, we are victimized, because that's what people do, you know, that's human nature. So if they too were miserable, that's very easy to jump on that bandwagon. But that doesn't mean that there was a real problem in the world, and that it was societal, and that it was because the traditional family structure that we had in place at that time with one breadwinner and one homemaker was meant to oppress women. And that is what she convinced people of. And it was a lie. And that is what we begin with the book. And it's important the reason I only mention the Marxism is important for people to know that she was involved in Marxist politics and that she actually joined a communist party. That's relevant. It doesn't mean that people today who are feminists are communists. It just means to understand the context of how this whole thing began.
It's definitely an important part of the story, and you know, you mentioned that these were people that were upset with the typical family structure. It seems to me that almost all forms of liberalism involve someone being a misfit in one way or another, or having a bad experience. And I don't mean to be cruel with that, but I mean these are typically people who just do not fit in
or do not cope. Right.
Good point. Now,
yeah, you're absolutely right. I agree with you. And that takes on a life of its own. You know, one of the things that we also talk about on Flipside is this victimhood mentality. And women on the left know, because everything is based in victimhood. The whole left mentality is victim, victim, victim. Well, that is a very natural human response. So it's very easy to get people on board with that, because it's much easier to point fingers than it is to take responsibility for yourself and your own life. And so what we try to do in Flipside is to show that there were plenty of women who were taking responsibility for their own lives, and, by the way, plenty of women who were working outside the home before feminism ever came along. Do you know that in 1963, nearly half of American women worked outside the home?
Yet if you hear feminists tell it, no one worked outside the home until they came along and broke through that
glass ceiling.
And
that's correct. It's a myth. It's a lie. I mean, that's the whole point of Flipside, is to put this whole thing in perspective and to tell you something that you may not want to hear, but you cannot consider yourself truly educated about this until you get the facts first. You can make up your own mind when you're done, but you need the facts first, and the gatekeepers are keeping you from getting that information. They don't want you to.
Now, one of the things you also point out in the book is that feminists tend to dismiss, or I guess we could even say completely ignore, if I throw in my own comment, stories of successful women who do not fit their mold, you know, the Sarah Palins, Margaret Thatchers of the world.
Right.
What are some examples of some other women that they've ignored in terms of accomplishment?
Well, we do point out a couple of women, and again, they're not necessarily well-known names because you're going back there now in their 80s as well, but we name a couple of women, one of whom is Carolyn Graglia, and she was in the same class as Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who has sort of carried the feminist torch for decades and perpetuated these feminist myths about what life was like when she was in the 50s or what have you. But then we present a woman, a contemporary, same period of time, had a completely different experience than she did. So these are the kinds of women, and I don't want to get into details of it. You have to kind of read it to hear her story. And she's not the only one we provide examples for. Phyllis was another great example as well, so we use her story. And then my own mother is another example. These are all women who are now in their 80s whose stories paint a very different picture of a very different America in the 50s than the one feminists want you to believe existed. And probably the biggest myth is this idea that, like you said, feminists allowed women, that they didn't work out the home before feminism came along. But not only that, that feminism is what allowed women to get college degrees in addition to careers, that it's all because of them. Well, this is ridiculous. Women were getting college degrees long before feminism came along. My grandmother got one in 1920. All the women in my family have master's degrees. They're all in their 80s. So there's just so many stories of people who are successful, and you don't hear as much about them because, number one, they're not out in the forefront complaining. They're privately doing their own thing and making their way. Now, that's not to say sexism never existed. This book doesn't say you're all nuts. Sexism is all made up in your head. That's not the point. But sexism was only one ism. There's so many isms that people experience and harp on the left. I mean, men also get the shaft as well, but we never hear about that. I have two nephews right now who are actually being rejected from medical school because they're white and they're male. I mean, whoever talks about that? They're victims.
Absolutely they are.
There's all kinds of victims in the world, and women are not the only ones. And even if you do confront that, and obviously you're going to confront it much less today than you were years ago, but when you do confront it, there's more than one way to skin a cat. And starting a movement to change the entire way society operates is only one way, and it's the dumb way, the bad way. Ineffective way.
You talk about the victimhood mentality. It seems to me that many women who might feel that they're victims are actually victims of the feminist ideology. And by that I mean this whole idea that you don't need a man, they're glamorizing single parenting, and a lot of the hardships that these women face are because they followed the feminist blueprint and, slept around, decided to have a baby without getting married, and now they're stuck living on the government dole. So what's really going on here? Are they victims of society, or are they victims of the feminist agenda?
Well, I would say both, because the feminist agenda is fully inculcated in our society. And one of the points we want to get across to people with Flipside is that there are ways in which people were affected by this feminist culture, if you will, that they didn't realize. They didn't necessarily label it as feminist. There's many people who wouldn't even call themselves that. And yet their life and their lifestyles and their choices are a direct result of feminism's influence on their life, unbeknownst to them. For example, just about anybody under 50 years old today has been raised to focus solely and completely on a career. Since the time she was little, her life was supposed to be about this phenomenal career that was going to take center stage of her life. And it was going to be how you were going to be recognized, you were going to feel important, you were going to feel fulfilled, and that is how men have had it forever, which, by the way, is another lie. And so we're going to copy them and do it that way, because that's where the real happiness lies. So that's what they did. They tried to fit marriage and motherhood in around that as the center. In the past, it was the complete reverse. Marriage and motherhood was understood, or family. I mean, this same goes for men, too. Marriage and parenting, marriage and children. Guess we'll just call it family, was considered the center of your life, and the job that you had was just a means to an end. It was just something that you did to make that thing work. But the whole focus was family, and that is where ultimately we all, men and women, get our greatest sense of satisfaction and fulfillment. But once that was flipped on its head and people bought it, they found themselves in a pickle because in several ways. Number one, they find that, wow, this really isn't so fulfilling, and I kind of am expendable at work, and so work really isn't all that. That's number one. Number two, they followed a path, this path that we just described, and found themselves a lot older when they decided to have a family, and uh-oh, we have problems. Now, we have almost an epidemic of fertility problems today. Where do you think that comes from? I mean, we didn't have these 30 years ago. That is because feminism taught women that you can have children anytime you want and that there's no biological clock. You're not supposed to talk about that. If you mention, you know, facts like when women are most fertile, that is absolutely taboo, and the feminists will shoot that down. They did a study on college freshmen. We named this in the book, and a full, I think, 89% of college freshmen think they can get pregnant into their 40s. Now, that is an out-and-out lie, and there is a tremendous amount of information on fertility, much of which we offer in the book, that is obviously politically incorrect, but nevertheless true. And you cannot go forward. This is a serious matter. If you want to have a family, remember talking about people's lives here. They want to have children. They want to be a mom. You have to give them the facts and the right ammunition so that they can go forward and make good choices. And right now, they don't have that.
One of the things you talk about in the book is the importance of having a plan and actually engaging in sequencing in your life, which in a way does sort of allow women to have it all. Talk to the listeners a little bit about that.
Yeah, the book is extremely positive. You know, it's absolutely saying, without a doubt, women can have everything they want out of life, but the only way to really truly have it is to live your life sequentially so that you start, when you're young, planning out your future as best as possible, and obviously that's subject to change and usually does, but you assume that marriage and motherhood is going to be the focus of your life, and that you do have a window there as to when you can best do that, and that you want to stay home with those children at least when they're young, or somebody should, and assume that going into it. And that way, when you make the choices about what kind of career you're going to have, when you're going to do it, what kind of person you're going to marry, all of those things are taken into consideration so that things fall into place. Now, of course, you know, people will say, well, it can't always work out that way, and of course it can't. But the point is that that's the goal and that's the plan. And if you screw up along the way, I screwed up. I was married in my early 20s for 4 years, no kids. And this issue very much played into the decisions I made in actually getting divorced and moving back to the Midwest, where the standard of living was a little bit different or a lot different, and ended up marrying somebody here. And I now have 2 children. They just turned 8 and 11. And I made choices with that in mind, and sometimes that means, as I said, messing up and sort of fixing it. But it can be done, I guess, is my point. And so this, it just requires a complete shift in the way that you think about your life as women, and it goes against, it's very countercultural. It goes against what everyone else is doing, and that's extremely difficult, but that's all the more reason why we need books like Flipside to propel people along and give them something to work with.
I can't tell you how many stories just ran through my head as I was reading this book. I can remember being in one workplace and a female found out that she was pregnant and then had the ultrasound done and had it checked for sex, which is something everybody does now. They don't want to be surprised. And found out that it was a girl and started crying because, one, she, for some reason, felt that she needed to give her husband a son, and secondly said, there's only room for one little princess in this family, and that's me. So as you've talked in the book, that's really sad, but as you talked in the book about, you know, everyone being raised to believe that they're the center of the universe, I think that's certainly part of the problem. Now, and another thing I remember is being in, I want to say, Newark, New Jersey once for a training. It was a new job I had started in sales, and there was a woman there who was offered the job, but she had just had a baby.
And they said, well, sorry, the training class is on this day. If you want the job, you've got to go. So she actually left a baby that was only 2 weeks old to be able to take this job. And one night, saw her in the lobby of the hotel where we were being trained and just broke down crying. And I think the most memorable example I ever saw is that I was in a training class, a sales training class with a manager. And during the class, her phone kept buzzing, and she'd go out in the hall and get a message and then come back in. And this went on several times. And then all of a sudden, she came back after one of them and broke down crying and said, I've just made a decision to resign from the company. And what was happening is that in order to be able to do her job, her very demanding job as a sales manager, and I don't want to say the industry, but within this industry, if you're a manager and you're awake, you're working. That's part of what you give up if you want to be a manager. And what she was doing is she had a live-in nanny for her son so that she could be able to have this job. And she said, one, my live-in nanny only speaks broken English, but she speaks Spanish. And, you know, my four-year-old son now speaks Spanish better than English because he spends so little time with me. And secondly, she doesn't have a driver's license, but my son wanted to take swimming lessons this summer. And so she just was calling me to let me know that she had found a different neighbor every day of the week that could take my son to swimming class. And she said, you know, guys, I've thought about it, and my responsibility is to my son, not to my career. So I just called the home office, and I resigned. And she broke down crying, and everybody went around her and gave her a big hug. And as I was reading your book, all these stories just came forward of women who felt pressured to go out and be that super career person while, you know, ignoring their instincts and in some way or another paid a price for it.
And, you know, the saddest thing is that here we are today where women live longer lives than they ever have in the history of time. They have their whole lives ahead of them. I mean, you graduate from school at 22, roughly. You're going to die when you're maybe 90. I mean, that is so much time. And these years at home with your babies and toddlers, depending on how many you have, and let's face it, most people only have two these days. What is that? That's a blip on the screen. It's nothing. But you have to assume that and know that and really understand that going into when you're making your decisions before you ever get pregnant. That's the problem. And that's not what women are encouraged to do. You can't even talk about children when you're in college. If you talked about being a mother when you're in college, you'd be laughed out of the, you know, just as I suppose 1950s college women who weren't taking home ec or whatever, if they talked about wanting to be an engineer, might be sort of thought, well, that's strange. You know, it's just the complete reverse today. So,
oh, you just brought up something feminists can use against you, though. They're going to say, you see that in the 1950s, a woman who said she wanted to be an engineer would be looked at strangely. That's what our movement has brought to America.
But here's the thing. What they do is they hone in on, the feminists hone in on those few people. Let's put us back in that in those days. It's 1950s. Most women are going to college to quote unquote find a man and settle down or what have you. A, we don't have the numbers on. There's no way to have numbers on how many women, what their reasons were for going to college and what they were. We can find out what they got degrees in, but not what their reasons were. But very few did want to go into engineering, so that was really kind of a dumb example. And even today, very few want to go into engineering. Now, that's something that's very irritating to feminists because they would want the engineering school, which is heavily dominated by men, to be 50-50, you know, male-female. And the fact that it's not, and never may never be, is very upsetting to them because the ultimate goal is to have men and women be completely interchangeable. So they would hone in on that maybe one woman, right, who wanted to go into engineering in the 50s, but she's so rare that it's in the grand scheme of things, it doesn't even matter. I mean, okay, so she's a little odd for a few years or whatever, and she deals with that, but you don't change the whole of society for this one woman. I had somebody comment on the BU, again, going back to those BU comments, that if feminism saved just one abused woman, if feminism rescues and gives a voice to just one abused woman, then it's worth any of the negatives. Now think about that. I mean, that's basically saying that in order to save what she believed would be saving an abused woman through this huge social movement, it's worth a social movement that has resulted in divorce, STDs, abortion, children without their mothers, fertility problems, men's rights, all of this stuff that has come of this social movement is worth that one woman who might have found a way to get out of her marriage thanks to feminism, which there's no even proof for anyway. I mean, generally, people who are in those very unfortunate situations, first of all, we have more help in the United States than we have than anywhere else for women like that. And it's a very unfortunate, sad situation. And that's wonderful to give attention to that group, but that's not a reason to change all of society. I guess that's my point.
Well, I don't recall anybody in the feminist movement saying that it was all about rescuing women from male partners who physically abuse them or verbally abuse them.
Isn't that interesting? Because that's what came of this whole BU thing. The overwhelming majority of the comments were about that, were about that exact issue. When, in fact, that didn't even... they'll say that that's what came of it, that that's what feminism does today. But when you talk about real abuse and real oppression of women, like in other countries, feminists are nowhere to be found. You don't hear them in the media being concerned about the terrible atrocities that are happening in third world countries to women. If they pointed over to where real oppression is, then all the things they're fighting for here in America would look ridiculous.
Well, let's be honest, they pick and choose their victims even within the United States.
Sure.
I mean,
well,
they haven't lifted a finger to defend Sarah Palin because she doesn't support abortion. And, you know, you look at the beauty pageant queen, Prejean. I mean, where were they in defending her? And you could even ask the same thing about Monica Lewinsky. I mean, because she was being sexually harassed by a liberal Democrat who happened to be president named Bill Clinton, they actually issued a statement of support for him. And according to Tammy Bruce, who at the time was the now chapter head in Los Angeles, she, you know, they got some, you know, they got this huge grant to put out anti-smoking campaigns as a reward for supporting President Clinton during the Lewinsky deal. And then you can go to Nicole Simpson. You know, the same story. I mean, it involves Tammy Bruce, but they didn't want to jump on that bandwagon because they didn't want to offend African-Americans who are also liberal.
Well,
so
it's a very specific agenda. And in Tammy Bruce's book, The New Thought Police, she has her own stories that she lays out there for what the real agenda is. And it's not even remotely close to what they tell people.
That's exactly true. Now, one of the things that liberals like to do to discount any theory being brought forward by someone on the right is say, oh, my goodness, you're a conspiracy theorist. Oh, another right-wing conspiracy theory. And one of the things that you sort of suggest is that the left enjoys promoting single motherhood because these are people who end up on some form of government assistance, and people on government assistance tend to vote a straight Democrat ticket when they go into the voting booth. So is this some sort of a conspiracy theory on your part?
Oh, I don't use that phrase myself, but it is the underlying goal. I'll put it that way. You know, the family, the traditional family setup, married parents, children, someone at home, at least part of the time, that whole scenario is in direct opposition to feminists' goals. So their ultimate goal is to have women be independent of men. And of course, if you're independent of men or husbands, you've got to replace that with somebody because most women have children. So ultimately, that system that we had in place before has to be replaced with another one, and that's government. And a lot of people, of course, don't take the process this far in their head to think this is really what they're ultimately going for, but it is. So single women who are now at a whopping 40%, which is astounding. I mean, that is an astounding number. That works just fine for them because ultimately that's where they're going to get their votes. Do you know that most single women, the majority of Obama's base was single women, voters. By and large, single women voted for President Obama. That's not an accident. That's not a coincidence. So if you're going to oppose the family, you have to replace it with something. And that is why, by the way, at the end of the book, we say that the biggest chasm that we have today is between everyday American women who are largely, or everyday American people, I should say men and women, who are largely a right of center bunch, and the research proves that. And they're up against a left, a very left group who have all the power. And so that is, that's a tall order. That's a big deal. You know, that we've got to bridge that chasm, and we're trying to do that now, of course, with alternative forms of media and, of course, the Tea Party movement and all kinds of, and the flip side of feminism, books like that, that can do what we can to sort of overturn that power, which when you mentioned the ERA, we that Phyllis fought back in the 70s, we... You may remember that story in Chapter 2, and it's really an excellent story, isn't it? It really shows what the grassroots movements can do.
Absolutely. One person deciding they've had enough and making a change.
Mm-hmm.
It's also what the Tea Party's trying to accomplish now. You know, it's interesting. You point out in the book that the feminists like to draw parallels between their movement and the African-American movement.
Yes.
And unfortunately for them, I think the real parallels that stand out is one, it's ironic that feminists are saying, essentially, I don't want to be dependent on a man, but it's okay to be dependent on a government. And you point that out. And then with the African-American movement, you know, of course, it was first about ending slavery and then about having equal rights. But how many African Americans are in a situation where they are enslaved on what Star Parker calls Uncle Sam's plantation? So in that regard, the movements are very similar. And another way they're similar is, again, I'm not sure that when they have their little meetings behind closed doors that Democrats aren't perfectly comfortable with all these women who are struggling to be single moms who are on welfare and African Americans who are struggling financially and having to take some form of government assistance. I don't think they care about that at all. They're just looking at both groups as a voting bloc. So I guess if you want to draw parallels, that's two ways in which you can do it.
That's right. Now, their biggest argument with the civil rights movement was that women were slaves to men, or I should say wives were slaves to husbands, in the same way blacks were slaves to whites. That is so insulting to the black population, I can't even stomach it. That is so insulting. You have no comprehension of what it's like to be a slave in the old days, we'll just put it that way, and to compare women in the, you know, in the last 100 years in any way or shape having anything in common with black slaves. It's insulting to the black experience of this country, you know, the history. That's number one. But the biggest issue regarding what you're talking about has to do with the terminology that feminists use, or just women on the left use, to appeal to people's emotions. What you're dealing with here is, you know, they come up with very benign terminology. Anything that has something with rights in it is going to sound appealing to people because people are prone to say, rah, rah, my rights, my rights. They're not prone to say, rah, rah, I have a lot of responsibility. I got to get to it. So, but whenever you appeal to their victimhood mentality, you're going to get a lot of followers. And so that, and feminists know that. So that parallel was very purposeful. And again, it goes back to what I was saying about Betty Friedan and how she was able to get people on board in the 60s in the first place.
The other thing they like to do is, they bring up the word justice. I mean, there's social justice, economic justice, environmental justice.
Yes.
And what's interesting is that Al Gore even attempts to draw a parallel between the global warming movement and the anti-slavery movement and the African-Americans' equal rights movement. He'll be speaking to, and one of the kids caught it on their cell phone, he'll be speaking to groups of high school kids, and he'll be saying, you know, the kids know things that their parents don't. You know, back in the 50s,
mm-hmm.
you know, kids would be asking their parents, you know, why is it we're mean to African Americans again? Why is that okay? And now kids, you know that we need to do something about the environment, even though their parents don't get it. So whether it's global warming or the feminist movement, liberals love drawing that parallel however contrived it might be, with the in the equal rights movement, and even going back to the abolition of slavery. They love drawing those parallels, because to suggest that their movement isn't legitimate would be to suggest that you think black people should still be slaves, or that black people shouldn't have equal rights. And, of course, who wants to be put in that position?
Or, like in my case, that women should be barefoot and pregnant. That's my favorite one. And, of course, the cover of the book, as you see there, is very provocative because it does have a picture of a pregnant woman, which is supposed to sort of get them riled up because, of course, that's the first thing they ask me is, what are you saying, that women should be barefoot and pregnant? And that's, again, how you appeal to people's emotions. And, you know, the younger you are, and that's why the college campus is a breeding ground for this stuff, is they're just too young to buck the crowd and think for themselves. I mean, I hate to be condescending about it, but they just are. Very few people of that age are going to, you know, step outside what everyone else is doing and do the reading and the research. I mean, they just don't until they're older. So it's very easy to get them when they're young. And that's the scary part.
I remember being taught as a young man, I'm 47, by the way, I'll be 48 in a month or two, and I remember being taught at an early age, you don't care what other people do. I mean, I'm
right.
a little older than
you,
and, you know, of course, the drug culture was there and everything else. And I can remember my mom and dad both harping on me, do not worry about what other people
me
are
too.
Doing.
Oh,
if other
that's
people
funny.
Are so, yeah, and in fact, they would say, you're a bright young man. If anything, other people should be following you for not taking drugs and all these things. And that stuck in my head. I've never cared what other people think. I've never followed the herd, and I think we just have way too much herd following.
Oh,
way too many.
Agree more. I mean, I'm more passionate about that fact than feminism. That's the crux of it. It just gets me to no end. And I too had a mother who, I remember she used to sort of scrunch up her nose and eyes and goes, well, and she'd say, well, who wants to do what everyone else is doing anyway? How boring, you know? And I always have that in my head.
Well, you know, one of the fun things about what I do here is as I'm reading a book, I know that within, you know, depending on what stage I am in the book, 72, 48, 24 hours, I'm going to be talking to the author. So I mark little things, and I do have one little bone to pick with you from a male perspective, and I'm going to do that. On page 62, you state, the average male does not ruminate over who he had sex with or why he did it. He knows why he did it. Nor does he.
That was my favorite line.
That's
Sorry.
My least favorite line. Nor does he have sex with a woman because he wants her to like him. Men have sex when it's available to them, period. All right. Now, I want you to – this isn't the kind of thing I normally announce on the air, but I want you to know that when I met the woman who became my wife, I was a virgin. Okay?
Okay.
And all right. And
well, then you're exempt from this. That doesn't mean
well, I don't want to be exempt because I don't like the idea that, you know, men are so unsophisticated that if they're presented with sex, they automatically go for it. I think that's just a major, major misstatement of fact. I mean, I think that's almost a feminist view of what men are. Ooh.
Now, that's interesting because I would say that your story for today anyway, and I can only speak for the 40 years I've been alive on this earth, is unusual. Now, I could be wrong, and that could just be my experience, but I would say that most people are not virgins today when they marry, unlike...
I didn't say I was a virgin when I got married. I said I was a virgin when I met
Oh, excuse
my
me. Sorry, sorry. Gotcha. But I'm saying virgin... how do I put this another way without getting...
Well, to have only had one sexual
front.
Partner, is it, yeah.
Yeah, or in my case, excuse me, I can tell you right now, sitting here, I am the only person that I know in my life right now who has not had casual sex. In other words, who has not had what you today call a hookup. In my life, I don't know anybody who has not engaged in that at least once except me. Now, that's a little bit too much personal information. I certainly didn't get into that in the book. But meaning, my point by that meaning that I think it is more unusual today to find that. It's not really a right or wrong or good or bad. I guess you could say it is. But it's still Don't you think it's more unusual?
Oh, I think it's unusual, but, and I'm not going to suggest that, you know, all men are a bunch of Phil Donahue's and Alan Alda's and that we're all super, super sensitive, but to suggest that when men have sex when it's available to them, period, that makes it sound like all you have to do is walk up to any guy and say, you want to have sex, and he's going to say yes.
All right, you're right.
Okay, I expect a correction in the third
frame. A reprint.
With a small footnote with my name on it.
Okay. That's great.
I'm sorry, it's okay, but I mean, look, I think stereotyping of any type is wrong, and there are some males who, and there aren't many of us who were virgins when they met their spouse to be, but, and I just realized my mother-in-law is going to be listening to this show, so I just gave something away I didn't want to give away. But,
okay, it was over the top.
It was. Okay. But that's fine. I'll permit you one. And that's the only one I found, because if I'd found another one, I would bring it up. But I've been in too many little workshops where feminists get up and start saying a man is this and a man is that.
Oh, well,
and,
that's true. You're right.
And I'll raise my hand and say, no, that's not necessarily what a man is. And, oh, I think one woman one time said men are incapable of expressing a lot of emotion. And as somebody who, and because I once wanted to be an actor, I can cry on demand if I want to. So, you know, it's one of those things where maybe I'm just an odd guy. Okay, so the time we have left, tell me what a woman should do. Let's say there's a young woman listening to this right now, and she's a Tea Partier, so she's conservative, and she's actually going to listen to us, unlike the BU students who wrote to you in anger. What is that blueprint? What is that plan for making sure that they have a happy life? Because you pointed out in your book that since the 70s, with all this liberation, women are actually less happy. So what does the young woman today do to lay out that agenda or that blueprint that's going to make that person have a happy life?
Okay, so the very first thing to do, well, several things. Number one, ignore the culture and what they're telling you or it is telling you is the quote-unquote thing to do. That's number one. Number two, surround yourself with like-minded people. That really helps. And do a lot of readings, because the reading is where you're going to get the messages that are opposing, that are opposite of the culture. But then assume the exact opposite of what the world or the culture is telling you to assume. Do not assume that you are going to go out and have some phenomenal career that's going to go on for 50 years and it's going to be the focus of your life and bring you all of your happiness and fulfillment. That's number one. You can engage in those activities. You can have a career. You can do those other things, but they are part of your life. They are not the core of it. And they're not where you're going to ultimately get your fulfillment. While they can be satisfying, it's not enough. The real focus of where you're going to get your sense of happiness and fulfillment will come from family, for most people. So if you do want to get married and have children, and if you don't, then this doesn't apply to you, but if you do, and most people do, then you assume that that is the center. And you fit those other plans in around that. And there are some facts that you have to know in order to make that happen. Number one, there is a window, like we talked about before. It is easier to get pregnant in your 20s than it is in your, or up to the age of 34, really. And then after that, it just dwindles. So you don't want to deal with the fertility problems that so many people deal with. That's horrible. And that happens from poor planning. Not always. I mean, sometimes you just don't find someone till you're older, and that's one thing. But we're talking about a trend that is a direct result of feminism, where you can just do these things later when you get to them. That's number one. Number two, chances are you're going to want to stay home with those children. You may think that you're not, but that's probably because the culture is telling you you don't need to, and it's your choice, and you can't afford to anyway. That's all bogus. It's bogus. You are going to hold that baby in your arms, and you're going to want to take care of it, just like that woman that you explained who was conflicted and ended up crying and had to quit. You don't want to get in that situation. Just assume that you're going to want to be home with them. That will help you plan better in terms of the career choices you make and the choices of a mate, even, who you marry. And if you put those assumptions at the center of your life, then the chances of you being able to reach your goal are greater. It doesn't mean it's perfect, and it doesn't mean you won't mess up along the way, but it means you stand the best chance of having it all.
And, of course, people at home listening can also buy a copy of your book, which is going to spell it out in great detail as well. Now, if someone wants to get a copy of your book, I'm assuming it's available at all the regular places, Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com.
It is, but we've developed a website, which is the title of the book, TheFlipsideOfFeminism.com, and it's one-stop shopping for everything related to this book, articles, reviews, testimonials, and then where you can buy it and all of that.
Fantastic. And you're autographing all those copies, are you?
You know, we did autograph like 1,000, but they're gone. So
okay.
I don't know.
Well,
you might be
good.
Able to get it.
Oh, God. I'm sorry.
My publisher has. What?
I had to throw that out. I just wanted to have fun with you. Absolutely. This has really been fun. I've enjoyed this. We're going to have
good.
To do this. Yeah, I've had a wonderful time. I have to tell you, though, I enjoyed reading the book, and it lived up to its title because there are so many things in there that you said that the typical male cannot say without suffering some sort of backlash for saying it. And it's one of those books where you just read it, and it was a very compelling read. I didn't finish it in one sitting due to time constraints, but yeah, I could see myself on a weekend having done that. And you just sit there going, yeah, yeah, yeah. And it's one of those books where a lot of it was inside of me already, but you articulated it so well. And we need to give Phyllis credit, too. But it was just one of those things where you just feel like it needs to be on everybody's conservative book list. It's one of those things that it's long past due, frankly.
Yeah, you know.
Suzanne, it's been an absolute pleasure having you here today. I've enjoyed the book. People listening right now can look to the upper right-hand portion of the page and see copies of both The Flip Side of Feminism and The Seven Myths of Working. Is it Working Mothers?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, and they can click on either one of those in order, or they can go to, now what's the address for your website again?
It's the title of the book, TheFlipsideOfFeminism.com.
Excellent. They can go there and get a copy as well. Suzanne, thank you very much for being here today.
Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to the Tea Party Power Hour with Mark Gillar, a production of the Conservative Broadcasting Network.